Can you hear me? Okay, so as Daniel said, I'm going to continue in the same theme, quantum error correction, but I'm going to say a few things about how error correction can be used to perform reliable quantum computation. We say that reliable quantum computation is fault-tolerant computation, so it tolerates false noise. But really, this idea of using coding to perform computation is not something new and special for quantum computation. It's used all over the place for classical computation. In particular, it's very common when you transmit classical information in your cell phone or when you store classical information in hard drives. There are very elaborate coding schemes that allow you to store and transmit information at very high rates and very efficiently. Regarding classical computation, it's also true that some forms of coding are also used in that case. Although because the hardware of modern digital computers are very reliable, we don't really talk so much about encoded classical computation. Nevertheless, there exists a theory of fault-tolerant classical computing, and in a very important sense, it's very similar to the theory of fault-tolerant quantum computing. Most of the methods are the same. So let's say a few things first before we go to the quantum case about fault-tolerant classical computing. So the basic notion you want to have is the notion of a classical circuit. So this is a model about classical computing. So what's a classical circuit? Just a sequence of gates. So I'm going to draw diagrams of this form where time is going to flow from left to right, and the vertical direction is going to be space. Okay, so I'm going to lie my bits when I talk of classical computation in the vertical direction, or my qubits when I talk about classical computing. So a classical circuit is just a recipe of how you should manipulate a sequence of bits to get some outcome. So there are some bits, you do some gates, you combine them, and in the end you get some outcome, right? Okay, and the circuit is phrased in terms of some elementary gates, elementary binary operations. For example, this is a NOT. So it takes an input and negates it. If it's a 0, it's a 1. If it's a 1, it takes it to a 0. This might be an AND. So it performs the logical addition of the two inputs to the output, and so on. So if you imagine that you have a long sequence of gates, a very large circuit of that form, and say every elementary operation in this circuit has some probability to fail, say epsilon, then the probability that you get the correct outcome, if there is noise in the circuit, you expect to be something like the number of elementary operations, say L in the circuit, times epsilon, right? That's the probability that the outcome in the end is going to be correct, or that's the probability that there's going to be an error in the outcome in the end, right? So, of course, there's a problem if L times epsilon is of order 1, which means there's a problem if L is of order 1 over epsilon, which means if you just use the circuit as it is and every gate fails with probability epsilon, you have a problem if you have to do computations which are of order long, which contain of order 1 over epsilon gates. Okay? So what do you do? Well, you have many techniques that are used. For example, you can split up the computation into smaller parts and repeat the parts several times and then take a majority and then continue. That's one case. But there's a more complicated procedure that you can do, which is also more general, more efficient, which is you take every gate in your circuit, every elementary operation in the circuit, and you expand it and you make it an encoded operation now. and then you can correct errors. For example, perhaps the simplest scheme that you can do is you can encode your operations in your circuit using the simplest classical code, the repetition code, which means every time you see a wire in your circuit, you replace it by many wires. Okay, you say a wire becomes a cable. Okay, and every time you see a gate in your circuit, you replace it by a gate operating on every wire inside every cable. Okay, so there's a gate. Maybe I should expand it. So every wire becomes, say, n wires, and every gate becomes a gate on the corresponding wire inside the cable. Okay, because it's a repetition code, the repetition code just takes a 0 to many zeros and a 1 to many ones, say n in this case, right? Because it's a repetition code, every gate in the circuit is replaced by the same gate on every wire inside the cable, and so on, right? So, and now, after you do this replacement, you have some other procedure, which says some error correction procedure, which now looks at the wires inside a cable and does some majority voting and decides whether there are errors or not. So there's an error correction procedure which is done by computing some majority. And then you have the outgoing cable. Okay? So what they describe is a procedure with which you take any classical circuit and you obtain a larger circuit, an encoded circuit, where wires are replaced by cables and elementary gates are replaced by what are called organs. So this is an organ. That's a funny terminology. So every gate becomes an organ and you have many organs and so on. So this is the encoded circuit. And because you have encoded your information into a code that can correct errors, into the repetition code, you expect that the encoded circuit that has cables and organs is more reliable than the initial unencoded circuit, which has just noisy wires and gates. Okay, that's the idea. So all of this was discussed sometime in the 50s, 40s and 50s by von Neumann. And he proved that if the probability of an error in any of your elementary gates, if epsilon is less than some constant, he estimated that something like 10 to the minus 2, so 1 in 100, then you can make your encoded circuit as reliable as you want. So for any delta greater than 0, for any accuracy delta that you want, provided that epsilon is less than this fundamental constant, then the accuracy of the encoded circuit, then the encoded circuit has some accuracy. There's some effective probability of error for the encoded circuit, which can become less than delta for any delta you choose by choosing the appropriate code. Yeah. Okay, so we could say that's the classical accuracy threshold theorem. So what we hope to do is to derive something very similar but now for quantum computers. Yes. Oh, this constant epsilon 0? Well, it comes from the design. So there's an engineering problem, right? I give you a set of gates that I can make in the lab.
But they can be
that's right.
So you seem to be saying there's something intrinsic to it.
Oh, no. I said it's fundamental. I didn't mean it's a fundamental constant of nature. It's not,
okay.
You know, It's fundamental in the sense that it's very important, but it's not a fundamental constant of nature. It's an engineering constant, if you want. Yes.
But I mean, there's an upper limit that you can't get past, right? I mean, just, you know, to do air correction is going to involve adding some overhead, and to perform that, you need some number of gates. And if you add more gates, that's more opportunity for errors to occur. So there's kind of a trade-off between adding more things and correcting errors. And there's some limit to how well you can make it. You can't just set x1 0 equal to 1, you can make it sufficiently clever.
Yeah, well, there are limits to how optimistic you can be, but determining epsilon zero is tough. It's an engineering and maybe an analytical problem, or maybe you can do simulations. The same thing is true for quantum computing when we talk about quantum computing. Okay, so before I move on to quantum computing, let's observe what's important for deriving this result for classical computing. There are two things that are important. Okay, so the essential ideas. One is that the information is digital. Okay, so our computer is not arbitrary, it just encodes the information into wires that carry zeros or ones. Okay? Physically, they carry, say, some voltage, and the voltage is either very close to zero voltage or very close to some high value of voltage. Okay? And that's important because information is digital, we can do error correction. And the second important fact is that the computer is not arbitrary. It's restricted to having some specific set of elementary hardware operations, like a NOT gate or a NAND gate, so on. So there's a discrete set of gates. The low part you can't see. Okay, I'll just write one more line and I'll just say what I write. So the second important fact is that the gate is discrete, and that's important because to encode the circuit, it suffices to know how to encode every gate. Okay, so it suffices to know how to encode every gate in the set. Yes. That's for the classical case, but I'm gonna argue that the very very similar essential ideas are required for quantum computers. Okay, that's important because if I give you some very weird gate, classical gate, it may be that it's very hard or maybe impossible for you to derive an encoded version of this gate. But you don't have to, right? As long as you can do it for a specified discrete set, which is universal. When I say it's universal, it means if I give you this set, you can compute any computable function. If that's universal, then you're good. Okay, so let's move to quantum computing. Okay, so now we have quantum circuits. I'm going to use the same notation, where time is going to go from left to right and space is going to be vertical. Actually, sorry, I think I confused. So in this diagram, you can have another interpretation for the horizontal line. Instead of being time, it can actually be space as well. So if this is a wire, this drawing can also be the spatial layout of a circuit. Okay, you can think of it as a way too, but in the quantum case, this is necessarily time. Okay, and so when I write circuits, I'm going to have lines which are going to be the word lines of qubits. So I'm going to have some quantum states. say 0 or psi, and then I'm going to perform some operations on them, like a unitary rotation and stuff. Or I'm going to have multiple qubits interact like that, and then in the end I'm going to have something like a measurement. Okay. So let's use this notation. I'm going to use a script P for preparation and script M for measurement, if you want. If I want to specify what state I'm going to prepare, I'm going to put it as a subscript here. And if I want to specify what operator I'm going to measure, I'm going to put it as a subscript. So this is measures the operator A. So that's a quantum circuit. It's a prescription for performing some physical operation as a sequence of elementary physical operations that act on, say, 1 or 2 qubits at a time. A little bit bigger, yeah, sure. So in the case of classical circuits, you could perform any, you could compute any computable function by using, say, AND gates and NOT gates, or just an AND gate would suffice, and so on. So these are two examples of universal gate sets. In the case of quantum circuits, there are several universal gate sets. So there's a chance for some confusion because some people use gate to mean unitary gate. Some people use gate to mean physical operation, which includes things like preparation and measurement. So when I say gate here, I'm going to mean the physical operation. So a gate includes a measurement and preparation. So a universal gate set that is used very often for quantum computing is one that has this five operations. So it has the preparation of the zero state. It has the Hadamard gate. So this is 2x2 matrix. It has the control NOT gate. So this acts on 2 qubits, and it flips the state of the target qubit only if and only if the state of the control qubit is 1. This S gate is the rotation by around the Z axis in the Bloch sphere by pi over 2. And this T gate is just the rotation around the Z axis by pi over 4. Okay, so this gate set has only 1 2 qubit gate, the control knot, and all the other operations are applied on a single qubit. Oh, you want a measurement too, right? Thanks. And you want a measurement, measure, say, sigma z. Remember, sigma z is just this Pauli operator. Okay, any questions? Yeah. That's right, yes. I could do that. I could take that out. But sometimes sometimes it's helpful to have it in the set as a discrete operation because it may be hard to do T gates. So in order to do T gates, I may need some S gates. But yes, it's redundant. Okay, so remember the two essential things we had used to make classical circuits fault-tolerant. We used the digitization of information and the discreteness of the gate sets. Now, for quantum information, I already told you that the gate sets are discrete, so we have already number 2. Okay, and how about the digitization of information? Well, Daniel talked about it in his lectures. He said that it suffices for quantum code to correct, for example, errors in a Pauli basis, sigma x, sigma z, or sigma y, and then you can correct arbitrary superpositions of the three. Okay, another way to say the same thing is that in the quantum case, we encode information into orthogonal subspaces. One of those, we say, is the code space. So the quantum information ideally sits in that subspace, the code space. And then errors that are produced because of noise move the information into one of the other subspaces, which are orthogonal. And then digitization occurs just because we can be only on one of these orthogonal subspaces. When we find out on which one we are, that's digital information. We are either here or there. And as long as we know in which subspace we are, we know what to do to go back to the initial decode space. Yes?
But in the discussion that was in the previous lecture, we have the phase of the quantum state and we care about that phase. So doesn't enable us to have continuous information because of the continuity of the phase?
Well, yes, the phase information is important for quantum computation, but we're not when the information is encoded in the code space of a quantum error correcting code, it's important the phases inside the code space are important. Okay, but the information in which subspace you are among these various orthogonal subspaces is not sensitive to any phase information. You can just collapse on any one of them. Okay. So it's important to preserve the phases inside every subspace and in the code space in particular, but you can have information about in which subspace you are, and that's not affected by any phase information.
So in some sense, you are not going to care about the detail of the phase as long as it's not different enough to change the subspace.
Right. Well, you're only going to care about changes in the phase that you're not able to detect. So noise can affect the phases, but if noise acts on a sufficiently small number of qubits, then you're going to detect its influence by looking on which subspace you are. Right. The dangerous case is that if there's too much noise, too much phase noise, such that it keeps you in the code space and there's some non-trivial operation, and that can happen. If it acts on too many qubits all at once, this can happen, okay? But for this to happen, noise has to act on many, many qubits, and what we're going to say is we want to quantify on how many qubits noise needs to act before this happens. Any other questions? No? Okay, so let's write down what we want to prove. So the quantum threshold theorem, in analogy to the classical threshold theorem, is going to be a statement of that form. It's going to say, this is going to say something about what the noise is. So, and corresponding to the noise model, there are different theorems, but let's just discuss the simplest of them. So say, suppose noise is probabilistic. With some strength epsilon. So this means suppose every physical operation you want to do succeeds with probability 1 minus epsilon, and with probability epsilon you don't know what happens. Okay, that's the very simplest noise model. Then for every delta greater than zero, which is going to quantify the accuracy that you want for the quantum circuit, and for every quantum circuit, say of size L, so for any quantum circuit that contains L elementary operations, we're going to prove that there exists some encoded circuit which is only moderately bigger, so it has size which is increased by some polynomial factor in the size of the initial circuit, in the logarithms of the size of the initial circuit. So there exists an encoded circuit which is only moderately bigger which has an effective noise which is less than delta. Okay, so the theorem says again, suppose that every physical operation, physical elementary operation in the quantum circuit, fails probabilistically with some probability epsilon. And suppose epsilon is less than some value epsilon zero, which we're going to determine. And now suppose you give me some accuracy that you want for your final outcome of the entire computation delta. And suppose you give me any quantum circuit that you want to implement, which uses gates from a set, from the discrete gate set. Then I can find a different circuit, an encoded circuit, which is only modulatively bigger. It's bigger by a factor of, which is a polynomial in the logarithm of the initial circuit, of the size of the initial circuit. And the encoded circuit behaves exactly as the initial circuit, so it gives the same output. Except that now the encoded circuit behaves as if the noise has a different strength. Instead of epsilon, it becomes something less than delta. Yes? Yes.
So if the epsilon still is very small, 10 to the power minus 10, that theorem is useless, right? There's no way to make it.
Sure, yes.
No way to make use of even the theorem exists.
Right.
So how small
your epsilon theorem is? Yeah, that's why the proof of the theorem is more interesting than the theorem itself, because the proof is going to tell you what epsilon zero is. And in fact, as I told you, there are different theorems depending on what the noise model is. So if you're a physicist, you will say this is a ridiculous noise model. For a quantum computer, noise is going to be much more complicated than just simple probabilistic noise. So you have to look at the proof of a different theorem, and that's interesting. And a different proof for a different noise model is going to give you a different constant. So all of these are important questions. In the classical case, you remember then? I think it's similar. I think it's the same. I think the depth, there's a difference in the difference in the depth, but I think the overhead for the size is the same. Of course, with a different exponent, but I think it's the same. There's another parameter which you can use to compare the encoded with the initial circuit. I just use the size, the total number of operations in it. A different parameter is the depth. What's the maximum number of operations you have to apply on a single wire, a single qubit? How deep it is. Okay. In the classical case, you can have an encoded circuit which is only a constant factor larger than the unencoded circuit. So just a constant times the initial depth. In the quantum case, we don't know how to do it yet. That's an open question. Yes.
You don't have control on delta. Any limit on delta cannot be too small.
No. Any delta you give me, it's good. Of L star, I can give you the precise formula later. It's somewhere in the denominator. It divides L or something like that.
Yeah.
It's L over delta.
So L
depends on delta? No, L does not depend on delta. L is the size of the computation you want to do. A delta is the accuracy with which you want to do the computation. These are independent parameters. Well, I said for every delta and for every circuit. So for every delta and for every L, in a sense,
yeah,
there exists an encoded circuit that does the trick.
But the statement is incomplete. You must get all the related to the related to the epsilon, yeah. The delta, how do you
relate
to the epsilon?
Well, the delta is not related to the epsilon. The delta is an independent parameter, as is L. An epsilon is also an independent parameter. It depends on your implementation. Okay. So there are many different things. One is the implementation, one is the accuracy you want to achieve, and one is what you want to do with your implementation, what kind of circuit you want to implement, L. All of these are independent parameters. Yes, yes. That's why I try to go slow. It's complicated. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so what I want to do today and tomorrow is kind of sketch the basic ideas about how you prove the theorem, because the theorem doesn't say very much unless you see the proof. Some people say it's complicated, some people say it's obvious. I mean, the theorem is obvious, especially if you know the classical theorem. You expect something of that form to happen for quantum computing. What's tricky is to prove it. Okay, so what are we going to do? Okay, so let's discuss some proof ideas. So, like in the classical case, we're gonna take every operation in the initial quantum circuit, the unencoded circuit, and we're going to replace it by some encoded version of the same operation. Okay, so now every qubit will become many qubits, say n. In this case, we say we have a block of encoded qubits. So every qubit is replaced by a block of n encoded qubits, and every operation that acts on a single qubit, similarly for multi-qubit gates, but let's do the simple case of a single qubit operation. So every gate applied on a single qubit is going to be replaced by some other operation. Let's call it use of L. So L stands for logical. There's some logical operation. Now this is just a black box for the moment. We're going to design it. There's going to be some sequence of elementary operations. So there's going to be many small pieces inside this box, which we want to specify. And then, like in the classical case where you had some error correction after the encoded gate, we're going to have some error correction step here. So there's some quantum error correction procedure afterwards. So that's what we have in mind. We take every operation in the circuit, the encoded circuit, and we replace it with some composition, some sequence of many more elementary operations. We're going to discuss how you do that. And then after we do that, we do some error correction step, trying to figure out whether noise has affected any of the operations and trying to correct the errors. Yes?
Are you assuming just a single logical qubit?
Well, yes, in this diagram, yes. But the circuit is going to have also multi-qubit operations, like a control knot. And then the replacement is what you imagined it would be. So if there's a two-qubit operation, say O, then what you're going to have is, well, two blocks of qubits, and then there are going to be some two-qubit encoded operation, and then there's going to be some error correction procedure on both of output blocks of the encoded operation. So something like that. Well, it depends. So the operation might be a unitary gate, in which case it's going to be replaced by some sequence of unitaries in most cases. It doesn't have to. Maybe you have to do some measurements inside here to simulate some unitary evolution on a smaller subset, subspace. Quantum error correction can be unitary, but in most cases you don't want to have it unitarily. You want to measure something and then condition on the outcome, you want to apply some recovery operation. Right, yeah. And there's this other complication that in order to do quantum error correction, you need to have some input of extra qubits. We call those ancillas because they help you do the error correction. So there's some influx of additional qubits, which in the end are going to be recycled. So they go in and they come out. Sorry?
The original gate operation, is that necessarily unitary?
No. In fact, you have to do this replacement both for preparations and for measurements.
Okay.
it's necessary. Right, so if the operation was a preparation, it wouldn't have an input, so I would take out this qubit, and in this case, it wouldn't have any input block, it would be something like that. So preparation becomes some encoded preparation. So if you prepare a psi here you prepare the logical version of psi, and then you do some artifacts. And similarly for measurement, if it's a measurement, there's no output qubit, and therefore there's no output block of qubits in the encoded version. Yes? Yes, that's the basic idea of this proof. Yeah, I see what you mean. It just means it's complicated. It's going to be complicated, and it is complicated, yes. I mean, you have to worry about all these things. What happens when I draw a circuit like that, in the encoded circuit, you allow noise to act on any elementary operation. Now, nothing is noiseless, right? So you have to worry about all these things. What if an error happens when you do error correction? Every elementary operation in the encoded circuit is going to have noise, and you have to include the analysis of that case as well. Okay, that's the difference between an analysis of that form and an analysis of a typical communication channel, where you have some encoded information, it goes through some noisy channel, and then you're free to do something else on the output, essentially without any additional noise. So here there's no noiseless step. But the other difference between this scenario and the communication scenario is that here there's no input, there's no output. There's no quantum input, and there's no quantum output. There's only a classical output, the output of the computation, okay? And you're not allowed to have any arbitrary input quantum state to your quantum circuit. So the quantum circuit is supposed to have it's supposed to start with states which are in this elementary gate set, namely zeros. If your quantum circuit starts with some quantum state you don't know what it is, somebody else gives you the state, then you cannot encode that circuit. You cannot make this circuit arbitrarily accurate. Okay, so provided your circuit only uses operations in this set, then you can encode it. Okay, so if we draw diagrammatically, if we sketch what happens when you encode a circuit, say the simplest case, say a very trivial computation would be, just for illustration, would be of that form. You prepare a qubit, and then you do some unitary rotation, and then you measure it. Okay, that's for illustration. If you want to encode the circuit, it would become some procedure for encoding the corresponding logical state. After you choose a code, and you encode the corresponding logical state, and then there's a step where you do error correction. And then there's some procedure for performing the encoded operation corresponding to this code, followed by error correction again. And finally, there's some procedure for performing the measurement of the encoded operation in this code. Well, you don't need the error correction after the measurement because the outcome of the measurement is a classical bit, or many classical bits. There's some classical output. So maybe what you need the output is some classical error correction. Okay, but I'm just omitting that. So I'm omitting all the classical processing in this drawing. When I write QEC, I just mean the quantum part of the error correction. Okay, so what we want to do is, so the idea of the proof is, say I draw noise in this form. So say this bold line represents some kind of environment or some eavesdropper that is not in mind control and is introducing noise to the quantum computer. And say I draw this wiggly line coupling the quantum computer up here with the environment, and I just put epsilon because epsilon is the strength of the noise according to the assumption of the theorem. When I encode the information, just because I encoded the circuit, the noise didn't change. So we still have the same situation. Every elementary operation in this circuit is coupled to some environment with the same strength epsilon. What we want to do in the proof of the theorem is we want to show that this encoded circuit is equivalent to an unencoded circuit where now the strength of the noise has been changed from epsilon to some other value. Let's denote it epsilon subscript 1, which is going to be something like some constant times epsilon to some power. So that's what we want to try to prove in the theorem, that the encoded circuit subject to the noise, the physical noise, according to the assumption of the theorem, is equivalent to, well, an unencoded circuit, like the one we started with. But now the noise that acts on this circuit is kind of renormalized. Its value has changed from epsilon to some power of epsilon, where T, I'm using the same notation as Daniel in his lectures, T is the number of errors the code can correct. And C, this constant, is some combinatorial factor. To be determined. It depends on what the circuit in, but what it depends on the specifics of the circuit and the error correction and stuff. And why is that cool? Well, it's cool because if this effective strength epsilon 1 is less than epsilon, the one we started with, what we said just expresses that the encoded circuit is more reliable than the unencoded circuit. It formally says that the encoded circuit is as if you had an unencoded circuit but with a different strength, epsilon 1, less than epsilon. So encoding helps. If epsilon 1 is less than epsilon, then encoding the circuit helps. Okay? And you can, well, if you plug in the formula for epsilon 1, you can see that this imposes some condition of epsilon, on epsilon, right? It says, it says that epsilon is less than or equal to, is less than 1 over C to 1 over T, something like that. right? So that's epsilon zero in the theorem. Okay, so in order to figure out what the constant epsilon zero in the theorem is, you have to figure out what C is, this combinatorial factor up here. Okay, so now to repeat, if the epsilon we start with is less than epsilon zero defined by this formula, then the idea would be that encoding the circuit in this way helps in the sense that the encoded circuit is effectively acted by a noise of strength epsilon one less than the initial noise we started with, epsilon. Okay? Of course, in the theorem, you want to make the effective noise to be less than delta. You want to make what delta is any small number you want, right? So can you see what the next step is? Just repeat, right. So if encoding the circuit took epsilon to some value epsilon 1 less than epsilon, then the obvious idea is to do the same trick again. So take every gate, every operation in the encoded circuit, and encode it again. Now you have a doubly encoded circuit if you want. And that should take the noise strength from epsilon 1 to some epsilon 2, which is less than epsilon 1, less than epsilon. Right? So if you do it sufficiently many times, you expect the noise strength to become as small as you want. Right? So I can draw a picture for that. Okay, so let's draw a diagram where there's time, space, and an encoding. So initially I have some, let's use this trapezoid to represent the initial quantum circuit you have. So the quantum circuit is composed of some elementary operations. Let's draw them as cycles. So I just draw two of them. There are many, but I just draw two. Okay, and zero means encoding. There's no encoding, zero encoding. Okay, so encoding the circuit once means take every operation in the zero circuit and replace it by some sequence of many elementary operations, some encoded operation followed by error correction. Okay, so inside here there are many elementary operations. I just drew two for illustration. Okay. And then the idea we discussed is just keep on doing that. So take every elementary operation and replace it by another encoded operation and so on. So you can imagine that you do that k times in total. Okay, so the initial circuit, the unencoded circuit, let's go differently. So after you've done this encoding recursively k times, you end up with some circuit up here, which is very complicated. It has a lot of elementary operations corresponding to this recursive encoding. Okay, and for every elementary operation in this circuit, there is a corresponding probability of a fault, epsilon, given by the theorem. Okay? Now, as we said, you can replace the encoded circuit, by an unencoded circuit, which has a different strength of noise, epsilon 1. So, if you replace the encoded circuit, this pink box up here, with the corresponding unencoded operation you did in the previous step, you should get a different noise strength, which is this one we computed on the previous board up there. Or a different way to write this is, that's a different way to express the same formula. So because you went from the K minus one circuit to the K circuit by encoding every operation once, if noise of strength epsilon acts on this circuit, it's equivalent to noise of strength epsilon one acting on the operations on this circuit. That's what we said up there. Okay? And now, so this is just a jump from the K to the K minus one. And then you can keep on doing that. And so it means look now at the pink boxes on the K minus one circuit and imagine the corresponding operation that generated this pink box on the previous level of coding. Now this is going to be afflicted by noise of strength epsilon 2, where instead of epsilon you have epsilon 1. So if you do the math, what happens is that in the end, after you do this k times this recursive encoding, it's like having the initial circuit you started with, the unencoded circuit, but now every operation in it is acted by noise of this strength, epsilon 2 superscript k, which depends on epsilon. It depends on the ratio epsilon over epsilon 0, doubly exponentially. So it's t plus 1 to the power k. So if epsilon is less than epsilon 0, this effective noise strength, that's epsilon effective in the theorem. This effective noise strength can become as small as you want by choosing k big enough. Okay, so let's repeat. So in the proof, we're going to have some formal procedure showing that an encoded circuit is equivalent to an unencoded circuit. And all that happens due to encoding is that the strength of the noise is changed from epsilon to some function of epsilon, some constant times epsilon to the power t plus 1. And then we're going to consider a multiply encoded circuit of this form. And started from the final circuit, which is encoded k times, we're going to kind of remove the encoding steps one by one. There are k encoding steps, and we're going to remove them one by one. Every time we remove an encoding step, the noise strength we started with is going to be changed by this function. It's going to be multiplied by some constant that's going to be raised to the power t plus 1. So when you go from the k to the k minus 1, epsilon is changed by this function. When you go from the k minus 1 to the k minus 2, it's the same function, except that instead of epsilon, you put epsilon 1 in the function. It's a recursive function. If you do it k times, that's the final outcome. Yes?
Two separate questions that are separate from what you said.
Yes.
So the first one is about L star. So that is like scaling in time,
right? No, it's a scaling of the size of the circuit, the number of operations you have in the circuit. Size.
So how about the time?
Well, the time is this other parameter I discussed, the depth. The maximum number of operations you need to apply on a single qubit. So if a single operation takes some time t0, the depth times t0 is the total, is the maximum amount of time you have to run your quantum computer. It's also increasing by a polylog on the size of the initial circuit. Of course.
Each basic operations have smaller noise, and then they put them together.
Yes.
Or I can just take the global circuit and then try to make.
No. In principle, that could be different, but no. It's much simpler to analyze the encoding of every single operation and then compose them trivially, one after the other.
So you have a morning, I mean, so you have really a universal way of trying to make any algorithm.
Yes, right. Right. So for any specific implementation, if it's very important for you, you may be able to design something smarter. Right, it grows exponentially with k.
Yeah.
But note that the effective, But note that the effective error rate epsilon drops not exponentially, it drops doubly exponentially with k. Right, so that's why you get the polynomial on the logarithm of l. It's because the blow up is exponential, but the suppression of the noise rate is doubly exponential, much faster. So in practice, you need to do it suffices to just have k scale very moderately with L and delta. Yes.
So will your pool depend on the socket or the quantum channel, or you know, we pay quantum channel any kind of communication?
Well, that's interesting. So, right. So it's interesting. Of course, the proof has to show some circuits, right? There's some construction that I didn't show you. Right. Well, traditionally, what happened is that people thought about designing circuits for simple noise models, like the probabilistic noise model I discussed. And it turns out, if you have circuits that are good for this type of probabilistic noise, then they're also good for other types of more adversarial noise, like coherent noise and stuff like that. It's not really an accident. You should be expecting that to happen. But if you, on the other hand, if you have a very specific noise model, you may be able to do something to design a very specific circuit that is tailored for this error model. And that circuit is going to behave better because it's going to have a better constant epsilon zero. Yes, but as a matter of principle, if you have a circuit that is good for probabilistic noise, it's probably also good for other types of more general noise. Yeah. Right. Well, you can. Well, yeah. Well, the theorem specifies a noise model. If the noise model you give me is different, of course, the theorem doesn't apply. Maybe I can change the theorem a little bit, and then it will apply. And that happens in many cases. But.
But it's certainly true. You don't need to know everything.
You don't need to know.
You know some general.
You need to know. Yeah, some
basic property, like it's uncorrelated, like, or something like that.
Yes? No?
Yeah. I wonder if best condition is an assumption or something that we know on each
other. You mean the bound on epsilon 1?
Yeah, I mean, that each, I mean, each level, I mean, when we go to the previous level, we've got the, I mean, effective list.
Yeah. Well, that's not, it's what we desire to happen. It's what we want to happen if we design the circuit properly.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen automatically, and if you do even one mistake in your design, it's not going to happen. Okay, so I have to show you, or you have to read. Perhaps I don't have enough time to show you an explicit full example, but there exist constructions of encoded circuits for which this formula is good, for some specific C and some specific T. That's not obvious. Yeah.
So this may take me too far afield, but so if I want to scale down the error in the end, so does the time and space cost they scale the same? Is the limit delta to zero or do they go? Yes, that's more like a simple question.
They don't scale the same, they have different exponents and different constants.
How different they are?
I can't tell you now, but I can look it up. It's it's an important practical question, yes. Especially the depth, the time blow up is important practically.
There are those
Cauchy
circuits that are physics where still the critical point in space and time, then signal will scale the same way. They're contradictory theories.
Yes.
They are contradictory.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so you can tell me what you would prefer to do tomorrow. What I was planning to do is to, well, go through a simple example of a code and the corresponding circuit and kind of discuss the basic principles of how you make the circuit satisfy properties of this form. So you can really correct more than one error, and therefore you go up until this step. You see, the beauty of this proof I described is that all you need to worry about is this part of the board. Once you have proven this, the other follows immediately. There's nothing more you want to do. It's just so all the effort goes into designing the circuit, the first encoding part of the circuit. Okay, let's meet tomorrow.